increasingly we are deferring decisions to AI on who to recruit, who to imprison, who to date, who to give a mortgage to, who to vote for, who to kill. To compound this sort of thoughtlessness, no one really knows how the most advanced algorithms do what they do. The training procedure in deep machine learning determines the settings of millions of parameters which interact in such a complex way that we have reached a point where even the creator of an algorithm doesn't really quite understand it completely.
That's Jude Brown, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jude Brown on AI's promise and peril. The rise of AI, artificial intelligence, is a major development in human history. Its ramifications are profound. What is it exactly? AI provides a computer program the ability to think and learn on its own. It's a simulation of human intelligence into machines to do things that normally humans do. A government advisory committee states that the emergence of AI as a dominant technological force has brought with it a wave of transformative possibilities for society, ranging from medical breakthroughs to driverless cars to greater efficiency. However, potential dangers posed by unregulated AI development range from biases in decision-making algorithms to massive unemployment, deepfakes, privacy issues, abuse of civil liberties, and even global security. AI is a classic double-edged sword, a mix of promise and peril. Our guest today is Jude Brown. She's head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at King's College. She's the author of Political Responsibility and Tech Governance. She gave the Alan Turing Lecture at King's College in Cambridge, England, in early May 2024. And now, Jude Brown.
I had heard many times the famous quote that concluded Alan Turing's 1951 lecture, Intelligent Machinery and Heretical Theory. It seems probable that once the machine thinking method had started, it would not take long to outstrip our feeble powers. There would be no question of the machines dying, and they would be able to converse with each other to sharpen their wits. At some stage, therefore, we should have to expect that the machines will take control. Now, this is an unnerving conclusion for Turing to draw, and so many commentators on AI since have aligned these words with a presumption that Turing was resigned to humanity's eventual doom. So when I went upstairs to the King's Archive and asked for Turing's papers, I was astonished to see that this is not how the lecture finishes in its original. Turing's conclusion is actually, at some stage, therefore, we should have to expect that machines will take control in the way that's mentioned in Samuel Butler's Erewhon. Now, Samuel Butler published Erewhon in 1872. He too had been here at Cambridge, but some 80 years before Turing. And it's an extraordinary work of fiction that tells the tale of a young protagonist who discovers a remote civilization, Erewhon. Now, as the spelling of Erewhon suggests, it's not quite nowhere. That is to say, it's not anywhere that we would recognize as such, but we would appreciate some of its features as its desire to create laws and rules and customs to ensure the flourishing of its people. And now there's a great deal you could say about this book, both bad and good, but I just want to draw your attention to the fact that Butler is asking us to imagine a human society that has evolved over time, disconnected from the cultural assumptions and political society that we find ourselves in as a reader. Now, Erewhon has many customs and rules that would seem strange to us, perhaps unjust and nonsensical, and then there are some that are politically radical. One of the big decisions that the Eronians have taken is that they have banned machines. The drastic measure taken by the Erewhonians was influenced by a prophet who some 200 years or so before the book is set, so the story goes, has seen man's increasing obsession and subsequently reliance on machines as the essential element of humanity's decline. Indeed, the prophet predicted that the survival of the human race quintessentially depends on the halting of machine evolution, which otherwise would be the last of our planet's dominant inhabitants. So here are some examples of the Erewhonian prophet's observations about humanity's relationship with machines. The art of the machines they serve that they may rule. They have preyed upon man's grovelling preference for his material over his spiritual interests. How many men at this hour are living in a state of bondage to the machines? How many spend their whole lives from cradle to the grave, intending them by night and day? Is it not plain that the machines are gaining ground upon us when we reflect on the increasing number of those who are bound down to them as slaves and of those who devote their whole souls to the advancement of the mechanical kingdom? Now, these fears written by Butler in 1872 are echoed today. Yudkowsky, for example, is a well-known decision theorist and lead researcher at the Machine Intelligence Research Institute in California, and he says in what is now a famous interview in Time magazine, "Many researchers think we're plunging towards a catastrophe, with more of them daring to say it in private than in public, but they think they can't unilaterally stop the forward plunge, that others will go on even if they personally quit their jobs. And so they all think they might as well keep going. This is a stupid state of affairs, and the rest of humanity ought to step in at this point and help the industry solve its collective action problem." Most likely, Yudkowsky was thinking of Elon Musk, who said recently, "If I could press pause on AI, or really advanced AI digital superintelligence, I would. It doesn't seem like that's realistic, so my company is essentially going to build AI in a good way, sort of hopefully." So let's just remind ourselves, I know we're all familiar with it, but let's just remind ourselves some of the issues with AI. Humanity's increasing reliance on AI is driven by compelling narratives of efficiency in which the human is a poor substitute for the extraordinary computational power of machine learning, the creative competences of generative AI, as well as the speed, accuracy, and consistency of automation in so many spheres of human activity. Indeed, AI is fast becoming the core technological foundation of contemporary societies, estimated by the World Economic Forum to contribute $15.7 trillion to the global economy by 2030. Of the world's biggest 10 companies, 6 are AI tech companies. And from those sorts of companies, Apple, Microsoft, Meta, Alphabet, Google, we have thousands of remarkable products, which the Erewhonians definitely would have missed out on. We all know about search engines, autonomous vehicles, astonishing medical diagnostic tools, ChatGPT, but focusing just for a moment on a couple of recent ones, which I find particularly extraordinary. There's AI-generated medium-range weather forecasts with unprecedented accuracy, and these are used as early warning predictions for extreme weather events, floods, tornadoes, hurricanes, heat waves. Now, this technology is called GraphCast, and its training data is a rich record of global historical weather of the past 40 years. This machine learning product includes 1 million grid points covering the entire Earth's surface And for each grid point, the model predicts a range of variables, including temperature, wind speed, precipitation, humidity, all at different layers of altitude, multiple layers of altitude, with extraordinary precision in a matter of seconds. And such a product is not only useful for everyday human planning, but a game changer for food security, emergency responders, and climate change researchers, and a plethora of other applications. Another one which is extraordinary is AlphaFold, which has predicted how 200 million proteins fold from a chain of amino acids into 3D shapes that enable them to carry out life's functions. And in fact, my mother-in-law's life work was making models to fold these proteins, and it would take a whole career to find one of these and get its folding into perspective. And this extraordinary AI product has provided vital information for nearly all known proteins to develop vaccines for malaria, for COVID, and it's essential to cancer drug discovery, and has led the way to something I find really extraordinary, which is plastic eating enzymes, which is being used now to tackle the 400 million tons of plastic waste that we produce every year. So these are, without doubt, huge benefits to our society. But of course, as we all know, set against a backdrop of remarkable technological innovation is a deep public anxiety about the prospect of AI-generated harm. We're familiar with it. Abuse of our personal data, sexist and racist biases of humanity being firmly compounded into our society by AI trained on the data of our behaviour and our views, deep fakes, misinformation. Another is technological unemployment. And I just want to spend a few seconds on this, really. Many studies and reports from academia and the corporate world make predictions on the fate of a range of human jobs. And most of these reports predict that by 2030, very much within our sights, some 30 to 40% of human-centered labor tasks will be at the risk of AI and robotic replacement. And you can see that the potential for automation of certain tasks in banking, energy, health, public service, defense is extremely high. We're repeatedly being told that the projected productivity gains in the trillions will be in those sectors where the most opportunity to substitute human labour are predicted to be those that are likely to see the largest productivity gains from AI. And a recent example is the announcement by BT that it will cut 55,000 jobs in light of the opportunities of AI by 2030. Now, the term technological unemployment was popularised by another King's Fellow, whose room we're in, named after him, John Maynard Keynes. And incidentally, he had been enormously impressed by Alan Turing and had been one of the academics responsible for permitting him into King's as a young scholar. Now, Keynes's famous article entitled Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren started out as a lecture to students here at King's in 1930. Keynes was worried that students disillusioned with social and economic inequality would be allured by communism. And he sought to convince them that if they were to hang on, new technologies would bring an end to material need. For Keynes, this was to be but a temporary phase of maladjustment, during which time technology would replace human labour to the detriment of the masses in the short term, but that in the longer term, it would in fact solve mankind's economic problems. Indeed, Keynes predicted that within 100 years of his writing, the UK's population could reach our destination of economic bliss, whereby technical efficiency would rise to such an extent that absolute material need would be satisfied with the minimum of labour effort. There will, he says, be ever larger and larger classes and groups of people for whom problems of economic necessity have been practically removed. And Keynes was very much looking forward to this future. I look forward, therefore, in days not so very remote to the greatest change which has ever occurred in the material environment of life for human beings in the aggregate. And today we have scholars such as Winchester, for example, who echo Keynes, that algorithmic revolution that's coming down the line will potentially release humans from what he sees as all the unnecessary knowledge that we carry around in our minds to facilitate labor that could be performed by AI. And he sees that this is freeing the potential for new forms of human genius. While others, including myself, have been less optimistic, with the rise of zero-hour contracts, economist and tech investor Bill Janeway here at Cambridge argues that it's not hard to see how the digitally enabled gig economy could become the ultimate realization of Marx's reserve army of labor, fully commodified human beings available to capitalism on demand. And under these increasingly precarious conditions, low to mid-skilled labor could be reduced to ever lower paid tasks that cost less than the costs of the automation. And on this particular point, Marx's observation in 1867 translates directly to contemporary concerns. The Yankees have invented a stone-making machine. The English don't make use of it because the wretch who does this work gets paid for such a small portion of his labor that machinery would increase the cost of production to the capitalist. In England, women are still occasionally used instead of horses for hauling barges because the labor required to produce horses and machines is an accurately known quantity, while that required to maintain the women of the surplus population is beneath all calculation. Hence, we nowhere find a more shameless squandering of human labor power for despicable purposes than in England, the land of machinery. The real challenge to the average person, then, is likely to be wage decline, unless politics gets its act together. What is more is that in the face of the disruptions to the labour market, many of the least educated are at the highest risks of AI, and the macro structural dynamics also that would ensue from high rates of technological unemployment. And with something of Keynes's optimism, for example, the UK government has freed up £117 million to fund PhDs for AI research, which is phenomenal, of course. But researching at the level of PhD caters to a tiny proportion of the future labour force, and it's not clear what those with less specialist training can expect in terms of employment opportunities in the future. So where is AI going? Well, in its sort of more basic form these days, you have supervised learning, so that's to say there's a human that teaches the machine what to do. You have unsupervised learning, is where AI spots patterns without help from us, but doesn't really know what to do with these patterns. So that's clustering, like the photos you get on your phone, for example. It will recognize a face or a particular dog and cluster those pictures, but there's nothing else kind of to it. Then there's reinforcement learning, and this is where the humans give feedback to AI's processes on whether it's got things right or wrong. And eventually, the AI is able to work out, you know, what is wanted, and it teaches itself. Artificial general intelligence is quite a leap from this kind of AI. It's to the capability of thinking for itself in abstract ways and a multitude of contexts with zero human input. And the leading futurist, Amy Webb, on AI says, it's inevitable. There's no off button. We're on our way to artificial general intelligence. And Shane Legg, who's the co-founder and chief scientist of DeepMind, says, we could have AGI by 2030. Certainly, it's going to be within 30 years. Now, Stuart Russell, who's one of my favorite computer scientists, and I would advocate listening to pretty much everything he says, is at the University of California in Berkeley. And he says, put very simply, AGI systems that are intelligent and almost certainly they'll be more capable than humans along all relevant dimensions of the intellect, those systems would be, in a real sense, more powerful than human beings. It's completely irresponsible to simply go ahead with this technology. So looking at the positives and negatives of AI, Amy Webb, the futurist, sets out two futures. The first future is a sort of optimistic account of AI that we see in the domestic and foreign policy initiatives of states and international organizations and the glossy materials of management consultancies and corporates, a future where AI development is grounded in the public interest with transparency requirements built into AI system designs, where humans are in the loop to provide oversight, individuals have control over their personal data, and where AI is supposed to support human labor rather than replace it. The second future is catastrophic, where power is concentrated in the handful of AI companies who aggressively curate user needs according to their own interests, with very negative all-round effects for the rest of us humans. Webb gives the optimistic future a 20% chance. So what are we doing to resist that catastrophic scenario? There have been a multitude of non-binding corporate national and international ethical guidelines which have been largely meaningless and ineffectual. As Timnit Gebru, who was sacked from Google for criticizing her employer's ethical approach, says, companies are just not going to self-regulate. We need regulation and something better than just a profit motive. Aside from ethical frameworks and self-regulating guidelines, there have been some serious attempts to get out in front of AI, most notably the EU AI Act. The cornerstone of the AI Act is a classification system that determines the level of risk an AI technology could pose to the health and safety or fundamental rights of a person. And the framework includes, you know, four tiers: unacceptable, high, limited, minimal. Now, AI systems within limited or minimal risk, like spam filters, for example, are allowed to be used with little requirements. Whereas, and there are very few examples in the unacceptable category, but where there are, an example of it would be generic biometric social system scoring, which is reportedly used in China with the general population, and that sort of thing is prohibited under the EU AI Act. Now, the Act really does have teeth, in that it has the power to fine up to 7% of a company's global revenue. That's a hell of a lot of money for some of those big tech companies. So that's a serious piece of legislation. And whilst it's impressive on many levels, and I'm an advocate of it, if we think back to Erewhonian Prophet, however, his concerns were much broader than averting a set of AI-related hazards, but rather the wider question of what sort of society do we want to live in? And what sorts of relationships do we want to have with technology? These are the bigger structural questions that go beyond reactive pieces of legislation like the EU AI Act. Now, although a controversial thinker with some views I don't share, I find Arendt's idea of thoughtlessness incredibly powerful in explaining how we fail to take up political responsibility to change something in society that may be acceptable according to the norms of that given society, but when you really step back and think, you realise that actually, politically, something really ought to be done. It's that collective action problem that we heard about at the beginning. Thoughtlessness, she says, is the heedless, recklessness, or helpless, hopeless confusion or complacent repetition of truths, which have become trivial and empty, seems to me to be among the outstanding characteristics of our time. The rise of AI, I suggest, makes us thoughtless. And I suggest it does that in two ways. The first is that increasingly AI is literally thinking for us. Asa Raskin, who's the former head of the user experience at Mozilla, explains that 2 billion people will have had a thought this morning that they didn't intend to have because a designer at Google said, this is how notifications work on that screen that you wake up to in the morning. And we really have to stop and think about that for a moment. 2 billion people. Increasingly, we are deferring decisions to AI on who to recruit, who to imprison, who to date, who to give a mortgage to, who to vote for, who to kill. To compound this sort of thoughtlessness, no one really knows how the most advanced algorithms do what they do. The training procedure in deep machine learning determines the settings of millions of parameters which interact in such a complex way that we have reached a point where even the creator of an algorithm doesn't really quite understand it completely. This is what is meant by the black box of AI and is becoming not so much a question of ignorance, but rather one of impossibility. So not only then are we perhaps losing something of our capacity to think for ourselves, we're also relying on AI that is increasingly opaque, and we also tend to assume that AI is authoritative because it has more data available to it than we do. AI gives the impression that data is selective as a particular output that has been definitively identified. That is to say, it has somehow been reduced down to an essence. This gives us the impression that the AI output has been placed beyond doubt. And yet, GPT, for example, is not an oracle of knowledge in the conventional way that we might think of and sort of don't stop to think about carefully. It is rather an algorithm that creates sentences based on the probability of a word occurring in a similar sentence within a large portion of the internet. That's what ChatGPT is. And according to OpenAI, who produce GPT, it has something in the region of a 29% error margin. And that's, I mean, that's obviously very variable on how you interpret the text as well. So another example of where the space for doubt is diminishing is in the context of AI weaponry. And already some of these products have moved from a human in the loop, which is where a human takes the decision to engage the weapon according to its proposed target, to human on the loop, where the human's role is merely to override the AI weapon if they judge it to be an error. Now, the appeal to militaries, of course, is the scale and speed with which these weapons can operate, but that, too, is the basis of public concern. The scale of an error is unfathomable. Now, in his 2023 new agenda for peace, the UN Secretary General calls for states to conclude by 2026, and there has been quite a lot of movement on this, a legally binding instrument to prohibit lethal autonomous weapon systems that function without human control or oversight. And AI scientists, such as Stuart Russell that I mentioned earlier, have been tirelessly campaigning in favour of such a ban. And I would urge you to listen to his BBC Reith lecture on the subject. So the second way in which AI can make us thoughtless in the Arendtian sense is the enormous power that tech companies have to mould our society in the shape of their interests. So that is to say, we're all increasingly living in a world both physically and socially designed by a handful of tech companies and whatever their commercial objectives happen to be. If you think about what the futurist Amy Webb says, she reminds us that actually, when we think politically, we mustn't be distracted by the assumptions of techno-determinism. She says, we should move beyond a techno-determinism that often takes two forms. One, which is techno-dystopia, you know, the catastrophe, and two, technology that will save us. It's inevitable and necessary. These are two seemingly very different outcomes. Both assume that we simply are affected by technology. She asks, how do we shape the material and digital infrastructure of our society? We should not assume that any technology is inevitable. Now, one of the obstacles we face in answering these questions, of course, is that our democratic systems are struggling, as David Runciman and John Dunn and others have argued that what modern politics most pressingly requires is a democratization of prudence, a spreading out of the burden of judging and choosing soberly about political questions across the entire adult population. Of course, part of the problem in getting there is that how do we get people to engage? Human beings are busy with their lives, leisure time is a premium, sorting out policy is not really a high priority for them. There's no time to engage in well-informed, thoughtful political deliberation in their everyday lives. Even for those who attempt to engage with the details of political debate before making a considered decision, most are only able to scratch the surface with little grasp of the detail, wider context, or future implications. This is what Downs calls rational ignorance. What tends to grow into the spaces created by rational ignorance are binary politics, in or out, with us or against us, group versus group. And these sorts of binary politics invariably lead us to new and renewed forms of division rather than prudence. An obstacle to the democratization of prudence on the question of AI is the extent to which states are captured by the tech industry. And by state capture, I don't mean corruption here, but rather the sheer weight of corporate interest built into the state's decision-making, where we are consumed with questions of which products are lucrative to market, which regulations are resisted. These are the kinds of questions that dominate the shape of our society's relationship with AI. Several writers, ranging from feminist structural theorists such as Iris Marignan, who's had perhaps the greatest influence on the way I think about politics, through to Mustafa Suleiman, the CEO of Microsoft, they all see social movements as perhaps, and perhaps mini-publics like citizens' assemblies, as the way to overcome the burden on the individuals in the public to act alone, to counter state capture, as I've described it, and to bring the interests and concerns of ordinary people to the front of how we grapple with these bigger structural questions, such as our society's relationship with AI. Certainly, much positive change to the way governments and industry respond to public calls of injustice comes through civil society. These sorts of approaches remain a vitally important mechanism of change, but they're not sufficient. Social movements tend to rely on methods of protest and semi-legal methods of occupation and obstruction, which can be very effective, but are often challenging to fund and sustain over long periods with directed effect. These methods also tend to be driven by a small number of committed activists who must galvanize larger numbers around big messages, but tend to struggle to bring those numbers into complex operative discussions on how to get governments to help their objectives.
You're listening to Jude Brown on AI's Promise and Peril. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Famously, when asked what action should be taken to combat climate degradation, Greta Thunberg, perhaps the most famous climate change activist in the world, replied, "It's nothing to do with me." This is, of course, not a statement about the lack of knowledge or imagination or care, but rather a reminder that our political institutions are where the details are bashed out into policy and where the large-scale coordinating power is held, like it or not. So I want to leave you with a brief sketch of a different idea that I think we ought to try. And I'm sort of compelled here by, again, Stuart Russell says that the success of his field is potentially to the detriment of humanity. And so I think what's imperative is the success of my field, of politics, in the general sense. And we have to put a lot more effort, a lot more thought, in the Arendtian sense, into the trends that are taking place and not lose sight of the collective action problem that we face, which is really considerable. So I think there's something really extremely powerful about a well-organized citizens' assembly, and I've written quite a lot about them. I won't go into huge amounts of detail here, but you have a large, diverse group of ordinary people selected much like a jury duty from a wider population, and they're brought together and presented with competing evidence from experts in a range of societal interest groups and the views of the wider public. It's a choreographed event for which you are taken out of your everyday existence for a set period of time and immersed in the details of a particular topic and required to think critically on how to navigate a given societal problem or challenge. Your deliberations are open to the public, but your decisions are anonymous. Now, I've been particularly interested in the citizens' assemblies in Ireland, which, and I'm thinking of the 2016 one in particular, which turned a totally divided nation on intractable social problems such as abortion, and led to an extraordinary national referendum which reflected almost exactly the decisions and the views that were eventually come to in the Citizens' Assembly. So there's something transformative. You can't really put your finger on it. These are conditions that you don't experience in an everyday, in the everyday. They have to be choreographed. You have to be lifted out and put into a particular context where you're exposed to different ideas, different competing sets of evidence, public views, interest groups, the whole gambit. And you think in the sort of Arendtian sense. But the problem with citizens' assemblies is that they're very expensive. So the one I just described in Ireland, was the cost of it was about 2 million euro, and it went on for well over a year. So that's long, cumbersome, expensive, and also citizens' assemblies tend to operate outside of our political machinery, kind of knocking on the window a little bit like social movements. So my suggestion is to bring them in. So when thinking about democracies, we tend to focus on the chambers of debate between elected members of government and opposition. But the reality includes a vast set of public body institutions whose function it is to work out the expert details and to make recommendations and think through the ethical issues, and then to feed that into the elected politicians' debates and decision-making. So in the UK, for example, but these exist in all sort of democracies, there are about 300 such bodies. There used to be 900. There's 300 such bodies. They employ about 300,000 staff, and they have budgets of about £250 billion. Now, in my work, I'm particularly interested in the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, which was actually first designed by a philosopher, Mary Warnock, who crystallised the idea that no matter how complex, and I think this is really important, no matter how complex the topic, laypersons should be involved, and no such authority should be unduly influenced by sectional interests. I've only touched on the general themes in a book that's coming out later in the year, where I spend quite a lot of time discussing the nature of politics and its relation to structural injustice. In the empirical example, I think about Warnock's ideas about what does this huge monster of a bureaucracy look like? What can it look like? And sadly, I mean, I didn't think she took her ideas far enough. I would definitely take them much farther. But even the ideas that she did have didn't really materialise in the way that she perhaps intended. And I write a sort of institutional history of where I think that kind of went wrong. But nevertheless, the HFEA has been a remarkably important body for the ethical and regulatory management of reproductive and genetic technologies. It is the gold standard in the world. It deals with really complicated thorny ethical issues like the creation of artificial wombs and embryonic materials and restrictions on human cloning. And these have been emulated the world over. I think about the limitations of democratic governance structures, but once imagined, once you get hold of this idea that actually there's something that's more than the sums of its parts with a lay element, the shape of it is pretty easy to sketch. And I think we should have some such body for AI. Now, the primary features would be much like a current model of a public body, funded through the state, operating arm's length to be independent of political steering. It's an ethical and policy-forming body which advises elected members of government on substantive questions and with subsequent regulatory powers. So not like all the advisory committees that exist around AI, which are packed with industry, but this would have a very heavy duty lay-centric element to it. obviously, the whole point of it, like a citizens' assembly, is to engage with expertise emanating from specialists from different perspectives and with the ability to explain and interpret the underlying technicalities of any particular question or concern. So in this way, the public, through these lay representatives, take on an active habit of political responsibility that you can't do in your everyday ordinary life. And this is the most important point. They provide a simple but potentially heavy counterweight to tech interest in policymaking. So to bring a range of lay voices directly into the mix of discussions around the relationship that society has with AI is an active, forward-looking approach. Should we permit technology in this realm? If so, how much? Should we tax companies for technological unemployment and environmental footprint? Should we ban lethal autonomous weapons? Should we insist on algorithmic audits for social media? Should we ban AI impersonation? I think the answers that we would get from a lay-centric body would be greatly different to the one dominated by industry, with only lip service to public polls and focus groups. A lay-centric approach would be a radical shift in our democratic operations, but one that I think is actually achievable. So many talks and podcasts, articles and books on the pros and cons of AI, like we've heard today, end with a plea for someone, whether it be you or the younger generation or the grown-ups, to take responsibility for protecting humanity from the spectre of tech-generated harm. What this someone is supposed to do is always opaque. There is never a blueprint offered of what should happen next, but there's always a description of how bad things will be if responsibility isn't taken up quickly enough. So rather than load up the future on our younger generations with the responsibility to correct our mistakes or defer to the elusive grown-ups, this is something we can do to steer the future to a place where we know the questions to which technology is or is not the answer. So having created remarkable technologies and tirelessly deployed his genius ideas to the war effort, Turing ended his life at the age of 41, having been subjected by the state to chemical castration for being gay, and it is a tragic and deeply unjust end. But Alan Turing was a man who believed in the possibility of the extraordinary. He was living proof of that belief. And what is required now is something of the extraordinary in changing how our democratic states function. We might not want to mirror the decisions of Erewhon, but we ought to at least overcome thoughtlessness and consider seriously the sorts of prophecies that motivated the Erewhonians' extraordinary solutions to the malign possibilities of AI. And I like to think that's why Alan Turing ended his essay in the way that he did. Thank you. Thank you. I don't want to give the impression that I'm a Luddite. I think technology is extraordinary. I find it, you know, a kind of magic. And I'm not advocating that we do what the Erewhonians did. But I am interested in the possibility that they are, you know, they can do something politically radical. And I, as I said, I like to think that's why Turing put that at the end of his essay, rather in the way that people usually think it ends. Now, there is something about the recognition of what happened to communities that were dependent upon particular technologies. And I think Keynes, sadly, was very naive politically about the generations that will really suffer if we just forge ahead with technological unemployment and say, never mind, it's all in the greater good. So I think those stories of, you know, whether it be looms or whether it be coal mines, or, you know, we have to be very cognizant of what happened to those communities. None of it was positive. And we should do better politically. So I absolutely think that there's a very important message from that group, but I'm not advocating that we just, you know, have a binary of, you know, against or for. I think technology is wonderful and it's here and it's developing, but we have to do better politics. You know, so you might say the same about genetic technologies, and yet the HFEA has done this marvelous job, and people see how it's worked, how it's facilitated research, in fact. It hasn't shut it down, but it's done it in such a way that's given trust, people use it, and there's a kind of forward positivity around these really quite ethically complicated technologies. So there's a reason to get involved. Then people say, especially you know, when it comes to sort of big, scary AI, well, China's going to do it, so this is what Stuart Russell says, so you know, maybe we should just keep that race going. But actually, China have regulated even more fiercely than the US have. And actually, there's a worry that the state will be undermined if all of these technologies and algorithms are flying around without any sort of control over them. So again, you know, the worries about technology are very real, but we have to do more to audit them. And there has to be a demand supply at the moment. You know, people put stuff out and people start using it, and then we see if it does harm. That's a really stupid way of allowing these technologies to develop. Whereas with drugs, for example, we do clinical trials, it's very rigorous. We should adopt that kind of mentality. We're not going to stop it all, but there's an awful lot that we can do. And I'm very clear that we shouldn't be throwing up our hands and saying there's nothing we can do. That defeatism is the opposite of political responsibility. So we just have to do it. Set good examples and try to bring people with us.
With GDPR, I saw a study recently that was talking about how it affected different companies of different sizes and their, you know, how much money they earn and how their day-to-day operations are affected, and with smaller companies, they found that you know the earnings of those companies were negatively affected, or maybe the I don't really know the right financial words, but they had to hire people to take care of the you know data and everything, and the bigger companies were less affected. They already had the resources, and I guess one worry there is that you know how do we build, how do we you know, handle regulation in a way that we don't, you know, sort of fuel monopolistic, you know, tendencies that these technological setups already have.
Yes.
So do you have any, yeah.
Yes, thank you. Two answers to that. I think that states like the UK ought to be investing so that smaller sort of entrepreneurial companies or individuals are not limited in, because they don't have these kind of resources. So that should be a directed state intervention into, you know, supplying grants to compliance grants, that kind of thing. So that's one way of answering that question. The other is that states have stepped out of this field increasingly. I mean, it used to be, you know, all the funding and research was kind of directed through the military, and then it sort of splurged out into other areas. And I now just with these huge tech companies, the states are clients. And I think it, you know, depending on the state, obviously, but they should step in more. They need to be at the center of development so that we're not just buying products from the tech companies and then, you know, putting them out there and hoping that, you know, see what it does to our society. We should be, and that's where, on a micro level, what I'm talking about is involved, where we're stepping in and saying what we want, and then we fund that so that it's viable, either for small individuals and companies or the big tech companies too. There's definitely no silver bullet here. There's no sort of future where it's all easy. That's not politics for you. I think it matters. I mean, the ICC will hold individuals responsible. It's not a lot in the moment, but it's something to set the future. And it does perhaps, hopefully, make some think about their actions and other organisations similarly. You're right. I mean, you know, we're all guilty of it. We're desperate to get something off the internet. Something pops up, we just say, yes, anything, just let me get to the site that I want to get to. And that's really terrible. And a friend and colleague of mine has working on this brilliant idea, which is called Data Trusts at Sylvie Delacroix. And this kind of middle, sort of middleman, if you like, which you can... It's sort of filtering your engagement with tech and data It does require an opportunity cost, so it's like investing. You basically have to say, oh, this data trust over here, I see that it will release my data to, you know, this environmental agency or this, you know, whatever, of who knows. And so you can sort of pick and choose what you're happy with. So there is that that investment cost. But people are thinking very creatively about how to get between you and just handing over all your data to these tech giants who are using it for their own profit and actually perhaps diminishing us a little by little. So I think we need to work with those really creative ideas. Yes?
I don't want to make it more complicated, but I think one of the issues with AI, it's treated as a separate problem from other things. And I think there are two obvious reasons why it's not. And the first is the most obvious, which is that AI is deliberately interfering with our political system and is clearly manipulating it so that when you have your citizens' assemblies, they are themselves going to be, you know, to some extent, controlled by the tech. And I mean, I think that's a problem. The other one, which nobody talks about but concerns me greatly, is the sheer energy costs of AI. Sadly, I put this all together for a lecture and I've totally forgotten all the numbers, but the sheer heat production of AI is massive.
Yes.
And it's going to compete with the major heat industries. So it's actually strongly related to the climate change model problem. And I think one needs to bring these things together.
Yes.
And it'll perhaps actually create greater appeal.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the Citizens' Assembly, I would actually bring them in to our governance systems. That is the kind of the thought there. And that would be a quite complicated but different way of doing policy decisions. And yes, I'm not going to now come up with a list of things that process ought to do, but you might say, well, we will tax companies for their environmental footprint heavily. You know, there's all sorts of creative ways that we can get to those issues. It's not ideal, but we need to do more to address those kinds of things that actually the public really care about, but don't, you know, surface so much in the kind of lists of, of the corporate interests and that they play the predominant role in these policy decisions. So what I'm asking is a choreographed shift. And I'm not really promoting any particular conception of the public good or whatever. I'm just saying that we need to shift that weight of interest and we need to do it quickly. And I suspect that we'll be looking at very different sorts of sensibilities and concerns.
I was thinking about what you said about the role of the Human Fertility Project, which had actually spread its influence throughout the world. You said all over the place people are recognising its importance.
Mm.
And how, when we have citizens' assemblies, say, happening here in Britain, to address questions, let's say, about weaponry or the labour issues you're talking about, you could get sufficiently universal, quasi-universal sort of morals points that would reach across boundaries, let's say, to countries which have got completely different sort of cultures and political stances, because that would be so important. I mean, particularly on things like, let's say, drones or whatever it is being widely used. You might nevertheless be able to reach across, but that would require the Citizens' Assembly to be a very special kind of way of thinking, I think.
What I've set out is something quite, you know, quite micro and detailed for certain contexts. So I'm thinking very much of a certain sort of democratic country like the UK and just changing the way that the bureaucracy of its governance machines. So, but I do think starting there, you know, is a kind of bottom-up approach. And I mean, the European Union, I mean, for all of its limitations, that piece of legislation is extraordinary. I mean, I don't think anyone would have predicted, you know, a decade ago that they would come in with some pretty heavy-duty legislation on, you know, Meta and Google. And, I just don't think they thought that was possible. But that is a collective. And as I said, China is regulating heavily because it has its own concerns and interests about AI and how it interacts with its society. So I think we have to be open and we can't just throw our hands up in the air, which I see so many commentators doing, saying it's all too much. You know, someone will break the agreement. Somebody will do it first. We just can't think like that. we have no alternative but to move forward and do the best we can and set the best standards and actually make it appealing to have great technology that is not a threat to us all. That's all we can do. Thank you very much.
You were just listening to Jude Brown on AI's Promise and Peril. She gave the Alan Turing Lecture at King's College in Cambridge, England, in early May 2024. Jude Brown is head of the Department of Politics and International Studies at King's College. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Naomi Klein, Ilan Pape, Tariq Ali, Medea Benjamin, Chris Hedges, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Jude Brown, AI's Promise and Peril, and for the classic book, The Essential Noam Chomsky, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Pink Floyd. Welcome to the Machine.